Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. There's a wrenching debate that affects people who are desperately ill and running out of options. At issue, should drug companies give them access to experimental drugs, treatments that have not been fully tested, but that just might, they just might save their lives, or at least grant them a few more years of life? If you or a loved one is in this position, the answer is easy, yes. But saying yes is not so simple. Drug makers often have only a limited supply of these drugs, which leads to difficult decisions over who gets them and who doesn't. Also, the drugs might not work. They could even cause harm. In response to this, Johnson & Johnson has become the first drug company to set up a panel of doctors and a bioethicist to decide how to respond to requests for so-called compassionate use of experimental drugs. Darshak Sanghavi knows about this firsthand, about this debate around compassionate use, because of his own father's fatal illness. Sanghavi is a pediatric cardiologist and professor at UMass Medical School, as well as a managing director at the Brookings Institution. And he wrote about this back in 2013 in the New York Times Magazine in a piece called How Dying Patients Get Access to Experimental Drugs. And he's with us now. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's good to have you, Darshak.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Also joining us in the studio is George Annis. He's a professor and chair of health law, bioethics, and human rights at BU. And welcome to you, Professor George Annis. It's good to have you.
Happy to be here.
And listeners, we'd love to hear you in this conversation as well. Have you tried to get experimental drugs for yourself, for a loved one? What's your view on compassionate use? Should it be up only to the patient to decide if they want to take a chance with an experimental drug? Do you think it's good that a drug company like Johnson & Johnson is taking this step? Or do you think it should be out of the hands of the drug companies altogether? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and at Radio Boston. And Darshak Sanghavi, I'd like to start with you. I want to ask you first about someone you wrote about in that New York Times piece, Sarah Broom. She was a 35-year-old poet who lived in New Zealand. When she was 29 months pregnant, doctors found a mass on her lungs. She underwent a C-section to deliver the baby and was diagnosed with advanced stage lung cancer. You met her in Cambridge. You talked to her when she told you about her last-ditch plan to save her life. So what course did she follow?
So, as many people are aware, lung cancer is really, really hard to treat. And this woman who had, you know, she was quite young, had several young children as well herself, really was out of options for anything that could treat that lung cancer. So she had even looked into, well, are there any clinical trials available, any experimental therapy, and there was nothing available. But it turns out that researchers had found that her lung cancer had a very specific type of problem, and that problem could be treated with a drug that was experimental and not actually technically meant for her, but for patients with different types of cancer. So her oncologist, who happened to be a Massachusetts general, said, well, this is your best chance to maybe survive a little bit longer. I think you should have this medication. And when she went to the drug company to see, well, hey, can we get it for you? They initially said, no, it's not available. You know, it's not approved. We can't sell it. And she doesn't really meet any criteria for our clinical trials. We're not going to give that to you.
Right. But she persevered, and eventually she got it, right?
That's right. And I think that this is sort of how compassionate use happens today, is that, you know, she's the first to admit that she was a uniquely well-positioned, well-educated person. You know, she could afford to travel to Boston. She lived in New Zealand, incredibly motivated. And not only that, her oncologist and her successfully personally lobbied the medical officer at the drug company, which happened to be Novartis. And then because of that direct personal appeal, you know, they showed pictures of her kids, like, you know, made the detailed scientific case. That's sort of how it happens. On a case-by-case basis, they then released the drug to her. She happened to take it, and then the tumor actually melted away.
Melted away. Right.
Yeah. And just to say, she lived for a while in really, really with an excellent quality of life. Unfortunately, years later, she did relapse and pass away. But it was clearly this medication and having it that allowed her to see her young baby who had been born, at least grow into a toddler, be there for her family for a period of years in very good health.
So there's a story of compassionate use that really delivered something. Now let's take another example that you wrote about. Your own father, who suffered from a very serious lung disease, signed up for a course of experimental drug therapy. It didn't go so well, right?
That's right. And I think that this is sort of the flip side. I come at it as somebody who at the time was a physician in training. My dad had this really rare lung disease where your lungs scar over years. And there was some preliminary data that showed that this experimental type of interferon might help his lung disease. But, you know, the medicine hadn't been approved or studied for this. And we wrote a letter to a company and said, you know, can our dad get access to this? My sister, who's a physician, and I both wrote it. And incredibly, they said yes. He took the medication and unfortunately did not get better at all. There were many side effects and he passed away. And then later, after a formal larger study was done, that study showed that this medication not only was not effective, but also had side effects that could cause serious problems and even life-threatening infections. So that's sort of, you know, coming from a personal standpoint, that was very traumatizing to us all and shows sort of the flip side of why we have these systems that encourage you to get into clinical trials as well.
Wow. Two stories there. George Annis, let me bring you into this conversation. Two stories there with very different outcomes. What issues do they raise about compassionate use?
Well, the first question they raise, of course, is whether there should be any such thing at all.
Right.
Whether we should just either put people in clinical trials or give them accepted therapy. And those are your two choices. Now, sometimes there are no clinical trials you can get into, and these are all very sad, tragic stories, usually of young people, not Darshank's father, but most people are young people trying to stay alive for a period of time to see their children grow up or whatever. And it's very, very, very hard for a physician to tell them, well, there's nothing we can do for you.
Right.
So historically, we've always tried to come up with something. Physicians have always tried to come up with something. And it's only been recently that one of the things they've come up with is knowledge of what's going on in the biotech field and the drug companies, what's in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And so now we can get, you know, if you're well connected or even if you know how to use the internet, you can figure out what's in the pipeline. And then the next question is, well, is there anything in the pipeline that might help me? And then you go to the drug company and try to get it.
Okay? Well, so now we have, and this is sort of the new news in all this, Johnson & Johnson taking a big step to create a panel led by a bioethicist and presumably made up of physicians to focus on these requests. George Annis, is this a good idea? Does this move us in the right direction?
Well, you want to be a little cynical about a drug company trying to protect itself from bad publicity because that's all they get when they turn down requests. They get flooded by social media, Twitter, Facebook, and demands. One company, Chimerix, was threatened with death. They said, we're going to destroy your company if you don't make your drug available. So the drug companies are now, I don't want to say they're desperate, but they were really looking for some way to take the heat off of them. And this seems like a possible way to do that.
All right.
Set up a committee. If it's really independent and it's really transparent, it might do some good. The problem with the committee always is, though, after they do more than a couple of cases, either that you're going to be able to see what criteria they're applying, and you can apply it yourself then, or they're going to wind up making arbitrary decisions, and you're not going to be able to figure out what they're doing, in which case it's outlived its usefulness.
Mm.
So it's not going to solve the problem. It's a temporary fix.
Yeah. Darshak Sanghavi, I'd love to ask you about this step that Johnson & Johnson has taken. George Annis, not very positive about it. What's your view?
Well, I think that it's important to at least try and put ourselves for a minute in the position of a drug company that's making this decision. And let's take one example of where, you know, there's a new medication that is very, very promising for certain types of cancer. It turns out that cancer is a very specific type that's not very common. So I remember last year when I was formerly at the Brookings Institution, we actually convened a meeting of senior leaders of major drug companies to try and see if we could advance and have them come up with an agreement. And just during that meeting, one of the executives showed me his email messages, and he had gotten like a half dozen direct emails to him from patients begging for access to experimental medications. Sure. And many of those were probably for cancers that weren't really going to be treated or successfully treated with these experimental medications. I think that the volume of requests that are given to many of these companies is truly extraordinary, and people are subject to a lot of pressure. So I think that one of the things that drug companies want to do is, I mean, surprisingly, I think in my interactions, they really want to do right by patients to some extent as well, even though it's sort of attractive to just say they're right for the money. They're humans as well, and they want to do the best they can. The issue is that when there's so many requests, they're coming from people that may or may not really understand which medicines are really the best for them. There should be at least some system or transparent way to give access to medicines, particularly if there's no studies that are available. So I think, what really is the answer? And I think that we don't know, but having a committee like this that at least is open and transparent, they have a procedure so you know who to call, you know who's going to look at your request. I think that's a positive step, at least in the right direction.
A positive step. But, George Zanis, I'm wondering, one of the points we made early on and thinking about the Sarah Broom story that Darshak told us, I mean, here was a woman who had the means, had the education to get her request to Novartis to use this experimental drug. Wouldn't there still be a sort of inequity in terms of who would have the wherewithal to get their request to this committee?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have inequity. It's the same inequity we have in our whole healthcare system, which is that, upper middle class white people are going to do very well. Poor white people and black people and minorities are going to do very poorly. You're not going to see them on television. You're not going to see them on Facebook, and you're not going to see large Twitter chains or even email sent to CEOs on their behalf. The problem, the real problem, is not with the patients that are dying. It's that we don't have any treatments for them. Mm-hmm. That's just the truth of the matter. And so they're willing to try anything, but, it's almost not even a gamble. I mean, the odds that it's going to work for any individual person are extraordinarily low. And, you can't blame the family for wanting their child treated, obviously, or their mother treated. But the truth of the matter is there is no treatment. Someday there will be one if we let it go through clinical trials and have it proven safe and effective. But if we don't, the shotgun effect, I think, ultimately doesn't really help anyone. It may help a few people. It's going to help a few people.
Sure.
But on the whole, it's certainly not a way to make national policy for medical care or drug care.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. We're talking about compassionate use. Have you tried to get experimental drugs for yourself or for a loved one? What's your view on compassionate use? Should it be up to only the patient? And what do you think of Johnson & Johnson setting up this panel to review requests for compassionate use? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to come back to you, Darshak Sanghavi, and thinking about these two stories. George Annis raised the idea that, maybe compassionate use is just not a good idea. You put a rather startling fact in the piece, in your New York Times piece in 2013, that only 6% of early stage cancer drugs ever come to market because they don't work, or else the side effects are too severe. That sounds like a pretty strong case against compassionate use if the idea, first and foremost, of medicine is to do no harm.
Yeah, I think that's, I think that we can all agree that what we all really want are proven, safe, and effective treatments for all kinds of bad diseases. And it's really important that when possible, anybody who can be in a study gets into a study, and we do the best we can to get information that helps people coming afterwards. But the truth is that we don't have studies for every rare disease that's out there, and there are some treatments that could be promising, but we just don't know if they're going to work. And so I think it's, compassionate use, it is about compassion. It's in the sense that we really don't know if it's going to work. This patient can't wait 5 or 10 years for a drug trial to be done and a drug to be approved. They've done the best they can to try to get into a study. Those studies don't exist. Shouldn't we have a way for that person to at least get the chance and somebody to listen with the advice of a really highly trained doctor who says, yep, this treatment might even help? I think that that is it's a responsibility, that's a moral responsibility for researchers to take on and address.
Yeah, George Ennis, I've got to say, listening to Darshak talk about this, I mean, fortunately, and I'll touch wood here, you know, I haven't been in this situation where I know of a loved one, if we could just get them this experimental medicine and give them a chance at an extra 4 or 5 years of life, you know, oh my God, I'd do anything to do that. But I can imagine being in that very, very difficult situation.
No, absolutely. And again, I don't say a word against the families. They will try anything. I remember when the father of the country's first little child to get a liver transplant was going around the country looking desperately to anyone who would help him. He said later on, and he actually did find a doctor who helped him, that had any doctor ever said to him, look, there's really nothing we can do. Just take care of her. Don't put her through any more pain and let her die comfortably. He would have done that. But no doctor actually said to him, there's nothing we can do. And I think that's what's going on here, too, that doctors won't say that, maybe hopefully because it's not true, that they really think there is some chance that some drug might help. And as long as there's not a higher chance that that drug could actually make your death worse. Mm-hmm. Again, it's hard to argue against that. What I argue against is that this committee is not going to help that. Could help the drug company, but it's going to be like the Seattle Kidney Dialysis Committee, which decided who got the next dialysis machine. And they wound up deciding that bankers and housewives with three or four kids got the machines and prostitutes and blue-collar workers did not.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to call. We're talking about compassionate use, the use of experimental drugs. Give us a call. Join the conversation. Let's go to Christine, who's calling from Weston. Christine, good to have you. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I worked for a pharmaceutical company, several of them, for 30 years, and mostly in the research area. And I think it's important for you to understand why the pharmaceutical companies are more resistant to include compassionate use patients in their trials. And it's particularly because they may be going for an indication of one disease, one specific type of patients, and the compassionate use patients may not even fit into that category, but all of their information in terms of side effects and effectiveness has to be included when the company actually goes to submit for the drug application.
Christine, we're losing you. Your call is breaking up, but we got the thrust of what what you said there, and I'm actually glad you call. It's good to have someone who represents the pharma industry. But George Ennis, I'm wondering if you could comment on what Christine was talking about.
Well, that's not quite right. You do have to include all the data if this person is put in the trial, even though they don't meet the criteria to be in the trial. But if it's strictly compassionate use outside of the trials, the FDA not only doesn't require you to keep data, they don't want it. They don't require you can't report it to the FDA. So, right. So this really is outside the clinical trial area. Right. That's what we're talking about.
Darshak Sanghavi, I'm wondering, should this be in the hands of pharmaceutical companies at all, or should there be a larger, I don't know, more independent body that would be entrusted with making this decision? I don't know what body that would be, but what's your thought on that?
Well, I think it's difficult. You know, I think just coming back to, I just want to make a point that we need to make these decisions, and we actually make these kinds of decisions all the time with, you know, limited resources, so to speak. You know, when somebody needs a heart transplant, we wish we had many more hearts that were available, but they're a limited number. And so we go through a process of trying to find out, well, how do we choose the person who would be the one who'd get that? And I think we do the same thing for these kinds of medications. You know, there's a limited supply of these medicines outside of clinical trials, and so there has to be some kind of process. Now, the issue is, well, where should that be? Should that be at the company, you know, or should it be something public, like, you know, something congressionally or federally created? Mm-hmm. And I think that no matter, here's the thing, no matter where we put that responsibility, they're going to make decisions that make some people happy and some people frustrated. And so I don't think that that's going to solve the problem to say we need a fancy blue ribbon commission and everybody will send the reports there. Drug companies, to some extent, they have probably the most expertise and understanding. They've developed the drugs of who might benefit. So the hope is that at least by having it there and having the process open and to some extent accountable to, you know, have an appeals procedure and so forth, that's probably at least the best way to go for now. But it's a complex problem.
Sure. George Annis, I'll give the final word to you. And just to chime in on that same question, publicly created entity or if we're going to have a panel like this at all, does it belong in the drug companies?
Well, we just looked at the organ transplant area in which we did create a private-public entity called UNOS to help decide what the criteria is for who gets the next hearts and livers. And that actually has worked pretty well. The bottom line is what we're talking about, limited supply, maybe doesn't work. We're talking about rationing. And he's right. Rationing is shot all through our healthcare system, but we will never recognize it. We do never explicitly say, look, we have to ration. We don't have enough to give to everybody. And we don't. And that's whether we're talking about hearts, livers, or just everyday medical care. And when we're talking about here, it's starker. It comes up in more relief so we can see it. And maybe that's the value of this committee, is that at least if it's public and open and transparent, we're all going to see that we actually do ration it, that the ZMAP case in Ebola is not an exception. It's more like a rule.
Hmm. Well, that's George Annis. He's chair of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. George Annis, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Darshak Sanghavi is a pediatric cardiologist and professor at UMass Medical School, as well as a managing director of the Brookings Institution. Darshak, thank you very much for joining us today as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can read a copy of Darshak Sanghavi's New York Times piece that he wrote in 2013 at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, the future of Internet ads and the surprising relevance of AOL. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.